VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman. Ukraine's bid to become a candidate to join the EU will get a clear signal next week. The bloc's chief, Ursula von der Leyen, announced in a surprise visit to Kyiv. Von der Leyen said talks she held with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will enable us to finalize our assessment by the end of next week. It's the first time the EU has publicly given timing on when the Commission will deliver its opinion. The bloc's 27 member countries need to decide whether to allow Ukraine to start accession negotiations. And Volodymyr Zelensky has urged international pressure to end a Russian naval blockade of Black Sea ports that has choked off his country's grain exports, threatening a global food crisis. Zelensky said in a video address to the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit in Singapore, the world will face an acute and severe food crisis and famine in many countries of Asia and Africa. Meantime, authorities in the Moscow-occupied city of Kherson in southern Ukraine have handed out Russian passports to local residents for the first time, news agencies reported. Russia's TASS agency says 23 Kherson residents received a Russian passport at a ceremony through a simplified procedure facilitated by a decree signed by Russian President Vladimir Putin. And on the battlefront, Ukraine's president says his country's forces are involved in very difficult battles, including in the eastern Donbass region, where Russia has focused its firepower. Ukrainian troops are doing everything to stop the offensive of the occupiers, Zelensky said. He added in his address that Ukraine must not allow the world to divert its attention away from what is happening. And U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued scathing criticism of Moscow and its goals in Ukraine at a summit in Singapore. This is VOA News. The average price of premium gasoline at the pump has surpassed $5 a gallon for the first time in the United States, the American Automobile Association reported Saturday. That record level, coming on top of months of soaring inflation, represents the latest bad news for U.S. President Joe Biden just 5 months before crucial midterm elections. A year ago, the average price of gas in the U.S. was just $3.07 per gallon, which means the price has shot up by 62%. The increase in gas prices follows a steady rise in oil prices, which soared further after Moscow invaded Ukraine in late February and as international sanctions against Russia, which is a major petroleum producer, began to bite. Higher gas costs pile even more pressure on U.S. consumers already struggling with higher prices for food, housing, automobiles, and health care. Political polling indicates that the economy, inflation, and high gas prices are now top issues for U.S. voters. Hundreds of demonstrators were rallying in Washington, D.C. and across the United States on Saturday, calling on lawmakers to pass legislation aimed at curbing gun violence following last month's massacre at a Texas elementary school. March for Our Lives, the gun safety group founded by student survivors of a 2018 massacre at a Florida high school, said it had planned more than 450 rallies for Saturday, including in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. In Washington, hundreds of people steadily arrived at the National Mall near the Washington Monument under light rain. The organization's 2018 march on Washington, weeks after 17 people were killed at that Florida high school, brought hundreds of thousands of people to the nation's capital to pressure Congress to take legislative action. The Republican opposition has prevented any new limits on guns from passing the U.S. Senate. U.S. President Joe Biden is a Democrat who has urged Congress to ban assault weapons, expand background checks, and implement other gun control measures. President Biden says he supports the protesters and calls for common sense gun safety legislation, which he says the majority of Americans want. The United States has rescinded a 17-month-old requirement that people arriving in the country by air test negative for COVID-19, a move that follows intense lobbying by airlines and the travel industry. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a four-page order lifting the mandate, effective on Sunday, saying it is not currently necessary. For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The ballot takers in Lesotho, we have checked all the printing facilities in Lesotho. They don't have security printing. So the ballot papers will be printed in South Africa. That is where they have security printing.
Elections in the Kingdom of Lesotho to elect members of parliament will be in October.
No acts will be undertaken which seek to undermine those judgments. So the interest of Botswana is in seeing the rule of law prevail, in seeing the law being obeyed to the letter.
The Law Society of Botswana calls on all government institutions to obey the law.
The operations of the Anti-Corruption Bureau is also hindered because of funding. Sometimes governments can delay funding just to stifle the operations of the institutions.
And a Malawian group calls on parliament to amend the law that requires the president and the vice president to declare their assets. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Elections in the Kingdom of Lesotho are scheduled for October. The chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission says the vote will be held after parliament is dissolved in July. Mpasa Mokgotshane says he expects the elections to be peaceful and transparent. His remarks come after the electoral body launched a voter registration drive as part of the effort to compile a list to be used for the elections. Prospective voters will elect 120 members of parliament in October. For the latest development, I reach Mpasa Mokgotshane, the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission of Lesotho.
The elections in Lesotho are coordinated from the dissolution of parliament. So parliament will dissolve in mid-July. Then we count 90 days from the dissolution of parliament. Hence, that's how we get mid-October.
So talk to me about preparations the Electoral Commission is putting in place in order to be ready for the elections in October.
Currently, we are doing intensified registration. So we are calling every Mosotho to make sure that they register for them in order to go and vote in mid-October. So that is the major exercise we are doing of calling everybody to come and register. Starting on Monday, it was when we started that intensification of registration. We register those people who are not in our voters' roll. So those who have registered in the past, we are displaying the voters' roll in their constituencies and voting stations. So they should rush and check whether their names are appearing on the voters' roll.
Since your call, how has been the response of prospective voters so far?
No, the numbers are promising. You see, like I've said, we started the exercise on Monday. So we are thinking that towards the weekend, the numbers of people will be rushing to our voting station to register. But as we have, it's still at the beginning, but the numbers, the interest is alarming.
What will be next in terms of the preparation for the elections in October?
Like I'm saying, the dissolution of parliament. We'll be taking out what we call the statutory timetable. The statutory timetable will be telling us when should we suspend the registration and when the parties are going to go for their primary elections, nominating the candidates who stand for the elections. So that timetable, we'll be taking it out. That will be the next step that we'll be doing.
What assurances are you giving the people that the elections will be peaceful and credible?
One thing that we tell them is that we are running the elections in the manner that the Electoral Act is declaring. That is the first thing. Second thing, we are having meetings with political party leaders. They have started their campaigns, and then we say their campaign should be peaceful. So all those things are the indication that elections are going to be peaceful.
What about the issue of working with the political parties as well as the security agencies? Because sometimes it becomes a little heated. Some people tell me and contest it. Others tell me, so how is the Electoral Commission going to work with the police to ensure a peaceful and transparent process?
The way we work in Lesotho, we have a number of consultative committees. Last week, we're working with another committee called the Security and Logistics Committee. Those are the people from political parties. We want from now on, they should understand, because we have taken out a tender for the ballot papers. So when we have identified the person who's going to print the ballot papers, the political parties, a group of them, a number of them, and staff of the commission are going to inspect that printing facility. Those are the little things that we bring trust to the people.
Will the ballot be printed in Lesotho or somewhere else?
Okay. The ballot papers in Lesotho, we have checked all the printing facilities in Lesotho. They don't have security printing. So the ballot papers will be printed in South Africa. That is where they have security printing.
Mphasa Mokgotjane is the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Law Society of Botswana is calling on all government institutions to obey the law. This following a legal battle between the Director General of the Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crime and the Directorate on Intelligence and Security. The anti-graft agency had sought a favorable court ruling to block the intelligence agency from accessing corruption files it was working on. Civil society and opposition groups say tensions and lack of trust between the two state institutions are disappointing and could undermine the country's democracy, rule of law, and the fight against corruption. This prompted the Law Society, which also advocates for the proper functioning of constitutional democracy, to call on the two organizations to operate within the confines of their official mandates. For more reaction, I reach Mboki Chilisa. He is the vice chairman of the Law Society of Botswana. He is also the chairman of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, in Botswana.
Recently, there has been a standoff between the head of the DCEC and the head of intelligence. The head of the DCEC's office was sealed by the head of intelligence, thereby necessitating the head of the DCEC going to court and asking that his office be unsealed and seeking preservation of certain dockets, because the head of the DCEC felt that the head of intelligence was trying to interfere in his work, in particular in corruption investigations that he's carrying out. So as the Law Society, we obviously became concerned that there is this unhealthy standoff between two organs of the state, being the security arm and the arm that's responsible for investigating corruption in the country.
Aren't these organizations supposed to work hand in hand in the fight against corruption in Botswana?
Yes, they're supposed to work hand in hand. And in fact, in terms of the legislation that establishes the DIS, the DIS is supposed to work harmoniously with other organs of state to ensure that both properly discharge their mandate in the interest of the nation. So it obviously causes great concern that they are at loggerheads.
Now, if you talk about the violation of the law that is supposed to ensure or enable these two organizations to work in hand in hand to protect the interest of the Republic of Botswana. Doesn't this undermine the very democracy Botswana jealously guards?
It does. It speaks to a lack of proper governance. It undermines the rule of law when you have organs fighting one another, encroaching into the domain of the other. So these are issues that have obviously caused great concern to the Law Society of Botswana. As the Law Society, one of our objectives is to promote the rule of law in the country. And we think that good government and the rule of law is imperiled when other organs start to interfere in the statutory mandate of other bodies.
The Law Society of Botswana called on the president to act. How can he act in this, and what role can he play in order to resolve this ongoing impasse?
Well, as the head of state, we believe that it's really incumbent upon him to get to the root cause of this conflict between these two organs. And it's also incumbent upon him to take necessary action when the head of one organ encroaches into the domain of another.
Mr. Chilisa, what should be the expectations of the people of Botswana regarding this?
Well, the expectation of the people of Botswana is that public officers will act in accordance with the law. Public officers would act in accordance with the duties as set out in the law, that public officials will at all times place the interests of the country and public interest up ahead of their own personal interests, that where judgments are given by court of law, such as in was the case in this instance, where the head of the DCEC was able to get a favorable interim judgment, that those judgments will be obeyed, followed to the letter, and no acts will be undertaken which seek to undermine those judgments. So the interest of Botswana is in seeing the rule of law prevail, in seeing the law being obeyed to the letter.
Mbulki Chilisa is the vice chairman of the Law Society of Botswana. He's also the chairman of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, in Botswana. He spoke with me from the capital, Gaborone. In Malawi, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition is calling on Parliament to review and amend the law that requires the President and the Vice President to declare their assets. The group contends that the measure in its current form fails to help fight corruption because it has no monitoring mechanism to verify the assets of public officials when they leave office. The group is also calling on stakeholders to put pressure on the lawmakers to amend the law. This after President Lazarus Chakwera and Vice President Saulos Chilima recently declared their assets as required. Gift Trappens is the chairperson of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC. He tells me that a new law must require all officials to declare their assets before and after they leave their posts.
As HRDC, maybe we would want to see more in terms of the information that has been provided by the Assets of Declaration Office. I think if you look at the information that came out, we didn't see the value of the declared assets. So I think we'd want just to see more in terms of that information that has been provided. But also, as HRDC, I think we'd want also to see this law not just for people to declare assets, but we'd want also to see people declaring their assets when they're also leaving the office. Because what we have seen is that this law is just a ceremonial, you know, law. Public officers just declare, but we don't track in terms of the accumulation of wealth when people are serving public offices.
Gift, are you saying the law as it stands now is not fit for purpose?
That's what we have seen. Citizens, I think it's not fit for purpose because we haven't used this law effectively. So I think it's a high time that we need to amend this law so that we're able, you know, to track in terms of how public officers are accumulating wealth.
Does that mean that there has to be an advocacy for Parliament to look at the law again?
Yes, I think as HRDC, we are calling upon the Parliament, but also other stakeholders, you know, to join hands to review this law, because as it is, it hasn't served the purpose in terms of our democratic dispensation. We have had this law, but it's not serving the purpose in terms of making sure that there is accountability at all levels from public officers.
Now, Gibbs, some people have also questioned the timing of the president and his vice declaring their assets because they thought that within a few months after taking power, people should know what their assets are. Why should they wait till after possibly over a year before declaring their assets up to now? What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's why I'm fighting the law itself, because even as citizens, maybe they're not aware in terms of the processes, in terms of how long does it take for someone to declare the assets. Of course, there is a limitation to that, but if people are not penalized, if they fail to declare in good time in terms of their assets as public officers, then I think the law is not working, you know, effectively. And that is why some of us, we are saying that I think it's a high time that this law should be reviewed.
Gibbs, some people are also saying that this asset declaration law forms part of the process to ensure accountability, transparency, and the fight against corruption in Malawi. What would you say is the current state of the fight against corruption?
I think for us as a country, we need to review a lot of laws to make sure that the fight against corruption is strengthened. And one of those laws, the ones that we are talking here, the Assets Declaration Law, but also we have also the anti-corruption laws that we need also to review. One of such is also to make sure that the whistleblowers are able to be protected by the law. As of now, whistleblowers are not protected. And we find that maybe a lot of citizens are afraid, you know, to provide information with regards to corruption because they are not protected by the law. But also, we need also to review laws, you know, that also govern around the appointment of the Anti-Corruption Bureau director, so that we empower more Parliament to, you know, appoint the ACB director, but not, you know, the president. That will make also the ACB being, you know, independent. But also, you know, the issue of funding, it needs also to be looked into. So sometimes the operations of the Anti-Corruption Bureau is also hindered because of funding. Sometimes governments can delay funding just to stifle the operations of the institutions.
Gift Trappens is the chairperson of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. The non-partisan group Care for Free and Fair Elections in Ghana, or Care Ghana, has petitioned the special prosecutor to investigate reports of vote buying in the recently held elections in the ruling New Patriotic Party, or NPP. The group also called on the special prosecutor to ensure those responsible for violating the country's electoral laws are made to face the full force of the law to serve as a deterrent. The ruling NPP recently held internal elections for the leadership of the party in cities across the country, including the capital Accra and Kumasi, the Ashanti regional capital. Care Ghana says it petitioned the office of the prosecutor to launch an investigation into allegations of vote buying. This after a defeated candidate in Kumasi claimed he paid $123 to each of the more than 800 delegates during the polling. Supporters of the NPP dismiss the petition as frivolous. They say that it appears the pressure group wants to score political points for opponents of the party. For more on the petition, I reach David Kumi Ado. He is the executive director of CARE Ghana.
CARE Ghana petitioned the Office of the Special Prosecutor, Mr. T.C. Ejaden, concerning a recent report on bribery, treating, and undue advantage in the recently held NPP inter-party election. And such things are in violation of our electoral laws. The OSP office is an office that has been given the mandate to investigate such matters and bring the culprits to book. So basically, that's the reason we petitioned the office of the special prosecutor, Mr. T.C. Ejaben. So he will look into the matter. If people are found to be giving bribes at the election, so they'll be prosecuted. We are doing this because we want to prevent any other recurrence, so our elections will not be for the highest bidder.
But David, some people are saying this is a uniquely internal party issue, even if the reports that you are citing are accurate. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know that regulations of elections in our country gives political parties the opportunity or people to form political parties. So with the political party, they can contest for an election and lead this country if people believe in their ideologies and their plans for the country. So basically, every political party in this country is a potential party that will govern this country. So it is an interest for us, any political party that goes into an election, because it comes into the political space. And if, God willing, such political party is voted for into power, and perhaps all those in that political party bribe their way through, and eventually they are criminals, but it means that we are going to have criminals manning our governance system, and you know what is going to happen. So basically, it is, yes, indeed, an inter-party election, but it is of interest to the entire nation. That is why the Constitution gives the Electoral Commission to supervise and conduct every election in this country.
What do you tell supporters of the party who are saying your petition is frivolous and that you are wasting public resources by making this petition just to score cheap political points for the opponents of the ruling party?
CARE Ghana is a non-aligned, non-partisan civil society organization. There are a lot of people who are contributing their quota to the development of this country, and we believe that we are doing the same. If stealing is stealing, corruption is corruption. In fact, I wasn't part of those who formulated our constitution, who put together our constitution. Therefore, I may not, or maybe my group may not be doing the bidding of any political party because we have not yet formed a political party. The development of this country is paramount for us. This is where we live. We are Ghanaians. There's nowhere else we can call our country.
What's next for your group if the Office of the Special Prosecutor does not take up your petition?
Okay, thank you. We've given the OSP a compelling evidence for which we'll have to compel him to look into the matter. Because one of the evidence we submitted to the OSP is Mr. Asare Degiakon. He was an aspiring chairman at the Ashanti Regional Conference that elected the Ashanti Regional NPP executive. He came out to say that he paid 1,000 Ghana cedis each bribe to every delegate. So he is not an evidence. So even the NPP guys who are saying that we are just doing this to score cheap political points, I think that you have to first speak to Mr. Asare Degiakon, an Ashanti man who contested for the regional chairman and lost. Now, we have a lot of belief and confidence in the OSP because our issue is not the first that he's taking up. He's dealing with one issue that went to court recently. It's also about bribery and corruption in an election.
David Kumi Ado is the executive director of CARE Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. We'll be right back. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Nigerian officials have blamed the terrorist group Islamic State West Africa Province, or ISWAP, for an attack on a church in the country's southwest that killed at least 40 people. Sunday's shooting at St. Francis Catholic Church in the town of Owo is the first linked to ISWAP in Nigeria's southwest, raising fears that terrorism in the country is spreading. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from Owo, Nigeria.
Nigerian Interior Minister Ralph Arebesola spoke to journalists in Abuja on Thursday, soon after a National Security Council meeting. He said authorities have monitored the situation for days and that, quote, from all indications, they are zeroing in on the Islamic State of West African Province, ISWAP. Arebesola warned Nigerians to be alert, but said the attack has no ethnic religious connections. He also raised concerns about recent killings over allegations of blasphemy in southwest Sokoto State and Nigeria's capital, Abuja. The church attack is the first time ISWAP, which has carried out many assaults in the northeast and northwest parts of the country, has been blamed for an attack in the southwest. The region was not one of the areas authorities were worried about until last week. Now, there are concerns that terrorists are expanding their enclaves to new regions. But Beacon security analyst Kabir Adamu says there are multiple reasons why ISWAP might have carried out the attack.
There are several factors. Number one is terrorism. Number two is political. And then number three, it may be a message being sent to the governor, his attempt to clamp down on marijuana producers within the state. And we're told that Owo is one of the key points where marijuana is being produced. A neighboring state, which is Kogi State, has witnessed a certain number of attacks, and it's possible that those groups may have crossed over into Ondo.
Ondo State authorities said the death toll has risen to at least 40 from Sunday's attack, with 87 others injured. They said some survivors have been discharged from the hospital. Armed men detonated explosives and opened fire at the St. Francis Catholic Church in Owo towards the end of the service. The street in front of the church is quieter than normal. People hover around the church, chatting in small groups, hoping to get the latest information about the attack. The resident priest declined to comment on the situation, saying it was affecting his mental health. A youth leader in Owo, who only identified himself as Comrade Olakosun, says local elders are trying to stop youths from carrying out reprisal attacks.
Threat abuse and the sense of reprisal are so high in the community since last Sunday. But given the fact that Kabeji has been so diplomatic in order to appeal to the community people to keep calm, that they will do what is just politically, traditionally, and culturally.
In a separate incident, authorities in Nigeria's northwestern Kaduna State said gunmen killed 32 people in an attack Wednesday and razed dozens of houses. Nigeria is seeing a wave of terrorist attacks and kidnappings a year ahead of presidential elections, and crime is certain to be a major issue in the campaign. President Muhammadu Buhari, who vowed to focus on security when first elected in 2015, is constitutionally barred from seeking another term. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Owo, Nigeria.
U.S. officials say they are working with Ukraine to export at least 3 million tons of grain to combat the world's growing hunger crisis, especially in Africa. Before Russia's invasion, Ukraine was exporting 6 million tons of grain a month. But Russia's Black Sea naval blockade means grain that could feed 400 million people is stuck in Ukraine. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Ukraine is stuck with millions of tons of grains in the country, unable to export to the rest of the world, which is facing food shortages and high food prices due to Russia's invasion of the country. Jim O'Brien is the head of the State Department's Office of Sanctions Coordination. He says there's enough food to feed millions, but Russia's invasion makes it difficult to get it out of the country.
So there are 20 million tons of grain sitting in Ukraine right now, waiting to get out. And again, in a normal year, all that would already be on the market. And it's not. And there's one reason. Now, there are many reasons that there's a global, that food security is weakened. But it's 20 million tons, which could feed 200 to 400 million people. It's just waiting on Russia's decision.
Russia and Ukraine are the grain basket of the world, and the two countries export a quarter of the world's grains. Experts say grain shortages in other countries dependent on Ukraine grains are creating high food prices and supply chain problems. On Thursday, Senegalese President and African Union Chairperson Macky Sall urged Ukraine to demine the Odesa port to help with grain exports. Speaking with French media, France 24 and RFI, Sall said if Africa does not get wheat from Ukraine, the continent will be in a famine that can create instability. O'Brien says Russia is reducing Ukraine's ability to produce its own food and food for the world.
Ukraine used to export 6 million or so tons of grain a month, mostly to the global south. And now that has had to stop. In March and April, it was very small. With our European partners, we're working very hard to get out as much grain as possible. But at best, it will probably be about half what was before. And that's because Russia has occupied or destroyed 30-odd percent of Ukraine's grain-producing capability. It is attacking grain storage and processing facilities.
The rise in food and fuel prices and a drought, which has not been seen in East Africa in 40 years, is making some 20 million people hungry. West Africa and the Sahel region are also affected because the countries rely on wheat imports from the two countries. U.S. Special Envoy for Global Food Security, Kari Fowler, says his country is supporting African countries to reduce hunger.
So we've made great efforts to try to, in an emergency situation, to provide more humanitarian assistance. But we've also announced somewhat longer-term measures. I mentioned earlier that one of our flagship programs at the U.S. Agency for International Development is our Feed the Future program. That involves quite a few countries around the world, but really focuses on, in a very intense way, on about a dozen countries, I believe eight of which are in Africa. We expect that program to be expanded.
The U.S. accuses Russia of stealing Ukraine's food and selling it to friendly countries. Samuel Nyandemo teaches economics at the University of Nairobi. He says Africa will refuse to buy stolen grain from Russia, but will look for other markets to meet the demand for food.
I don't think whether there will be an African country willing to buy stolen grain from Ukraine sold by Russia.
They'll look for better alternatives, particularly from Argentina and other Latin American countries, which are also very good in terms of producing those grains. The best solution here is that Russia should come on the table with Ukraine and they sort of this thing diplomatically.
U.S. officials say they are working with Ukraine's neighbors and the European Union to get as much grain out of the country as possible and support the initiative to lift the blockade on the Odesa port. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Yeah. can relax, let me work it. I could turn on you and thank you. I never thought I'd stand back with a woman so fine. Don't let go, no. Let me know what to do to you. Say my name cause it turns me on. I'll be giving you all night long. I know that you want me, baby, I'm ready. For the liquor, turn up the light. Give me slow wine, circle for me. For the liquor, turn up the light.
Jennifer, yeah, I'm looking for a girl called
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, those whose palm kernels were cracked for them by a benevolent spirit should not forget to be humble. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.